Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There was a bumper crop of good news today. Not banks or real estate, sorry to tell you. Agriculture is doing well, though. And before you say, so, think corn and food and ethanol and energy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us today. It is Tuesday, the 12th of August. Back in June, the devastating floods across much of the Midwest had brought predictions of even higher food prices. But since the rains came and went, the weather has been smiling on American farmers. Today, the government's latest crop survey pointed to what may be the second largest corn crop in history. And there has been a correspondingly strong recovery for some other key grains, including soybeans and wheat. Marketplace's Bob Moon reports that should bring some relief, not only in the cost of food, but in energy prices as well.
The Agriculture Department was fairly singing the good news today.
The corn is as high as an elephant's eye.
Okay, so those weren't the report's exact words, but they're close. Farmers are on track to harvest 12.3 billion bushels of corn this year, up nearly 5% from last month's forecast. And after soaring to a record of nearly $8 a bushel, corn prices are expected to drop to around $6 and perhaps below $5.
We're lucky because $8 corn would have been a very high burden for the American consumer to deal with.
Michael Swanson is an agricultural economist at Wells Fargo. He says cooler, wetter than usual weather helped farmers grow much more than they hoped.
This kind of gives us some breathing room. Can we have enough corn in the bins to not have to really be on a pure panic going into next year?
But it's not quite in the bins yet. These grains were planted late, so they need more time to grow, increasing the risk of freeze damage.
I was talking to people in North Dakota yesterday, and they're just hoping that the wind stays from the south instead of Canada.
If they hold up, lower prices will also be good news for livestock producers who've been struggling with higher feed prices. Chad Henderson is an analyst with Wisconsin-based Prime Agricultural Consultants. He says farmers see a flip side.
A simple way to look at this is with a $2 per bushel drop in the corn price on a producer who has 150 bushel corn, he's lost about $300 an acre in potential revenue.
That may sound like a raw deal, but Henderson says it's still a lot better than farmers were expecting just a few months ago. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We had a corn farmer on the program this past spring. Pete DeCampi is his name. He's got a couple of 100 acres of corn and soybeans in Lake County, Illinois. That's north of Chicago. Back then, he was trying to figure out how to take advantage of what were then record corn prices by selling his crop in advance, futures, basically. In light of today's news, we thought we'd get him on the phone to see if his take is the same as the Department of Agriculture's. Mr. DeCampi, good to talk with you.
Same here.
How's your crop this year, sir?
The crop is just a little better than average. I would say probably in the 40 years I've been farming, it's in the top 10%, but nothing near the top.
Do the Department of Agriculture numbers seem right to you based on your own perspective?
Most of the time they are right, but I can't understand why all the media that I'm reading and hearing about, they're not factoring in the acres that won't be harvested or that were planted and still won't be harvested. I think there's too much corn that had to be replanted, too much that was flooded out, and too much that didn't get planted.
What are you guessing your prices are going to be like when you finally get your crop to market? Is it going to do all right for you, or maybe not so much?
Well, I've forward sold quite a bit, so the price should be pretty good.
Forward sold. When we had you on the program back in April, you were hedging some of your bushels.
Right.
How much of a deal are you going to make on that? You going to do all right?
Yeah, we did about half, so we should be in pretty good shape. Unless the bottom falls out.
Unless the bottom falls out?
Yeah.
Well, what might make that happen?
The USDA saying that we have so many bushels.
And then, of course, the price goes down, right?
Right.
Are you worried at all about what effect these numbers are going to have on the price that you're eventually going to get?
No, because I think after harvest you're going to see it turn around. I'm not going to Vegas this year. I'm putting all my corn to bin.
And then what are you going to do?
We're going to roll the dice. I'm going to keep it till it goes up.
Really? You're just going to hold on to it?
Yep. What I haven't got sold.
Yeah, so you pre-sold some, but you're going to put the rest in a silo someplace and just hang on?
Right.
Doesn't that bring its own costs and risks as well? What if the price goes down?
Well, like I said, I'm not going to Vegas this year.
Pete DeCampi farms corn and soybean in Lake County, Illinois. That's north of Chicago. Mr. DeCampi, thanks a lot for your time.
Okay.
Farmers, of course, have to wait till harvest to figure out how they're going to do. Other businesses, though, can tell you a lot earlier what business is like. Television advertising is one of those. With big banks and automakers losing money hand over fist, advertising budgets have been cut way back. Even the Olympics have a downside to them. Advertisers don't want to be on shows that are competing with the games. But for a certain type of ad buyer, one who happens to be flush with cash, the down economy has created a rare chance to go bargain hunting. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
He's the biggest celebrity in the world.
And Obama was supposed to be the salvation for local TV stations. Well, him and that John McCain guy, and the hundreds of other candidates running for office. Evan Tracy tracks political ads at the Campaign Media Analysis Group.
The stations have been waiting for the political dollars as their, you know, in essence, white knight this year and what's been an overall bad advertising economy.
Presidential elections usually bring windfall profits to stations in politically competitive states. But this year, the depressed advertising market means a glut of airtime is up for sale. More than even all the campaigns can soak up, at least for the moment. And Kyle Osterhout, an ad buyer for Democratic candidates, says that's created a buyer's market for politicians.
There has been softness in rates and pricing.
Even honest-to-goodness discounts.
To a 15-20% level, sure.
And you know what that means. Evan Tracy says brace yourself for a barrage of political ads.
Absolutely. I mean, any time that something goes on sale, the tendency is to buy more of it. You know, so I think a lot of these markets are going to be exposed to a lot more advertising for a lot longer period than even some of them are used to.
Sounds like Christmas in August, doesn't it? And just what America has always wanted under the tree. More of this.
Just the party line. The Republican National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The dollar lost just a bit against most other major currencies today. The greenback has been on the rise the past few weeks, as we've been telling you. But its weakness earlier this year was reflected in the trade deficit report that came out this morning. Rising exports boosted by that weak dollar helped shrink the imbalance between what we buy and sell overseas by 4.1%. That's even counting the high cost of oil. Crude, by the way, down to 113 today. Wall Street down as well. It was more trouble in the credit markets that did it. The Swiss bank UBS said today it's going to sell off its investment banking business after billions in subprime losses. The company is going to hang on to its core business, though, its wealth management division. That is banking services for the really, really rich. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let me get your reaction to something here for a second. If I told you there was a report out today showing 2/3 of all Americans didn't pay any income taxes, would you be surprised? Outraged, maybe? If you are, calm down. There is no report saying that. But there is a study out today from the Government Accountability Office saying something similar. It finds that between 1998 and 2005, 2/3 of companies in this country had at least 1 year where they didn't pay any federal income tax at all. So, back to that outrage. Where is it? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has the story from Washington.
It's always easy to find outrage on Capitol Hill. Here's Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan.
Corporations used to pay a fair share of the tax burden in this country. They no longer do.
What will Dorgan be able to do about that? Probably nothing, says Harvard business professor Mihir Desai.
Well, it's very easy to point your fingers at corporations. It's very tough to actually get legislation passed that contradicts their interests.
Now, no corporations were named in the study, so it's possible many of those that paid no taxes made no money, though the GAO says companies reported trillions of dollars in sales during the relevant period. Cato Institute tax expert Dan Mitchell is one American who's not outraged.
We're all better off when American companies are doing well, so I don't buy into this mentality that it's somehow corporations versus people, because all corporations are collections of people.
Behavioral economist Dan Ariely is the author of Predictably Irrational. He says, for starters, Americans don't get outraged very easily.
When was the last time you saw a serious demonstration?
He says it's even harder for us to get all worked up over something as seemingly distant as corporate taxes.
There's no question that if people opened a newspaper and thought that one of their neighbors did not pay their taxes, they would be offended personally. But the fact that the company does it, it's not really clear to them where the money is going.
Ariely says if people knew how much they were paying to make up for corporations, attitudes would probably change. The GAO did not give a figure on that. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The official retail sales numbers are going to be out tomorrow from the Department of Commerce. But a company with an inside line released its figures today. Based on its credit card transactions, MasterCard's guessing sales were up about 1% last month, if you take cars out of the equation. That's a solid number, but a hair shy of expectations. It's tough in a down economy for retailers to figure out new ways to get consumers interested in what they're selling. But a family of winemakers in Italy has found a new way to promote its product, one you almost have to hear to believe. Megan Williams reports now on the new business twist behind the old idea of wine, women, and song.
On a hot, sun-bleached morning, the tour begins in the courtyard of Donna Fugato wine producers of Sicily.
So West Sicily and Pantelleria is an island between Sicily and Africa.
The Sicilian Arallo family began producing wine in the mid-1800s. 25 years ago, they came up with the Donna Fugata label. It literally means the woman who fled, referring to a queen who escaped to Sicily. The company now churns out about 2 million bottles a year, making them one of the top producers in the region. José Rallo, a striking brunette with a high-voltage smile, is the force behind the company.
Chiaranda is more international. It's a blend of Chardonnay and Ansonica. Chardonnay grapes are harvested in the night.
For José, a jazz singer, wine is about more than simply taste. Every wine has a harmony and rhythm, its own music. Take Benriet, Donna Fugata's prize-winning dessert wine.
Sweet, sensual, warm, fruity, was making me thinking to Brazil. Branquinha, pororoquinha, guerreiro,
sominha. Or the red that recalls Sicily's Arab roots, 1001 Arabian Nights.
Ah, mille una notte, 1001 night. I immediately thought about a jazz ballad. And the name of the ballad is perfect. An older man is like an elegant wine.
Okay.
Some things are worth waiting for.
José's recorded two CDs of her wine ballads and sells them over the internet. But what makes the singing more than a corny marketing gimmick is that proceeds go into a microcredit program. Donna Fugata lends up to $25,000 to budding entrepreneurs, pairing them with experienced local business people who act as mentors. Three new ventures are up and running: a commercial laundry, a delivery service, and a crafts business. In 5 years, José hopes that number will be around 100.
Sicily and the south of Italy have a lack of entrepreneurial culture. People are sometimes used to ask from the state, from the local municipality, and so on. So I hope that this project can change the mentality.
Italian wine expert Alma D'Avanzo says like more and more women who are running wine businesses in Italy, José's fresh marketing and community connection make the company stand out.
José is a big part of this because she's also embodies the modern woman and the Sicilian woman, which is a wife, a mother, and a manager, and a singer. And she carries all of this with a passion into the winemaking and into economical project, you know, a modern way of doing what should be done traditionally.
Like singing the blues, red and white.
Red is cool, white bebop.
In Marsala, Sicily, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
Red is the color, amber or white. A good wine, sweet sounds in my mind. Emotion, feelings, who can more? An older wine is full of life.
Coming up, Russia holds on tight to its breadbasket.
They know they cannot compete in biotech, they cannot compete in microelectronics. So instead, Russia is focusing on state control of the commodities, and grain is not an exception.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 1.2% today, 139 points to close at 11,642. The Nasdaq fell nearly 0.4%, 9 points, finished at 2430. The S&P 500 shed 1.2% as well, that is 15 points. Ended the day at 1289. Banks were the big losers. J.P. Morgan Chase bled 9.5%. Wachovia was off more than 12%. Citigroup and Goldman Sachs each gave back more than 6% today. Crude, as I mentioned, fell to $113 a barrel. That was good news for U.S. car companies. General Motors revved up more than 3%. Ford motored up 0.6% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.9%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the July retail sales report. The American Accordionists Association kicks off its 70th anniversary festival. Musicians participate in a squeeze party and compete for $12,000 in prizes. And the Berlin Wall began as a barbed wire barrier on August 13, 1961. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Top billing in listener letters this week goes to an interview I did with a pair of reporters from the Los Angeles Times. Julie Cart and Bettina Boxall spent a year looking into how much the government pays to fight wildfires. It's more than $1 billion. Listener and former Forest Service firefighter Jason Burke argues the money is well spent.
Sure, main camps have showers, generators, etc., but command-level people need communications, weather, and computer equipment to safely direct and support people on the line. And since they're more experienced and older, they get AC and cold drinks.
Older Americans were the focus of a different story last week. We looked at geriatric medicine, doctors who specialize in treating the elderly, and how there aren't really enough of them. Meg Bourbonnier from New London, New Hampshire, agreed with us, but she says we forgot another critical group of caregivers.
Geriatric nurse practitioners, and registered nurses. The shortage of specially trained nurses should also be a grave concern because outside of friends and family members, nurses provide the bulk of care to America's elderly population.
Commentator James Galbraith took aim at conservative economic policies last week. His point was that they've left corporate America with too much power to the detriment of the rest of us. Tyler Tate wrote from Lexington, Kentucky, to say he thinks America is still ripe for true Reaganomics.
The current miseries Galbraith outlines have not been caused by free market policies, but by a lack of them. Far from being dead and buried, unilateral free trade, deregulation, and low taxes combined with low government spending are the path forward to becoming a more prosperous nation.
We tapped into the wise perspective of Dr. Robert Coles recently as part of our summer book series. He built a course at the Harvard Business School around classic stories by John Cheever and William Carlos Williams, among others. And I asked him why.
I'll tell you what we're trying to do is change people in the sense to get them to stop, look, and listen. Just to think about life and its meaning.
Sandy Campbell from Siler City, North Carolina, said she thinks Dr. Cole's priorities are right on the money.
whenever we watch It's a Wonderful Life every Christmas season, it seems that everyone cheers for George, but then they go to their jobs the next day and they try their darndest to be Mr. Potter. It was just wonderful renewal of faith in human nature that there's somebody actually trying to clean up the greed and me that's out there.
I mentioned the other day that the Securities and Exchange Commission twitters now. That's the microblogging service that's so popular. Too bad I didn't get it right, though. I'm told the proper verb is tweeting or to tweet. So if you're online tweeting or whatever, drop us a line. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The Russian ruble enjoyed its best performance in 7 years today, to be expected perhaps after Russian President Dmitry Medvedev ordered an end to the war in Georgia. Commentator and economist Marshall Goldman says the international response to the Russian assault on its neighbor says a lot about the region's economic realities.
Playing chess against the Russian takes skill. The mess in Georgia is a good example. The Russians simply outplayed us. Initially, it looked like an easy win. When the USSR disintegrated, Georgia sought to keep as wide a space as possible between it and Russia. The Georgians worked hard and generated growth rates as high as 12% a year. While not perfect, their democracy was a vast improvement over what had existed previously. Russia was so weak, it couldn't rein in the various republics, and after its August 1998 stock market and economic crash, Russia was effectively bankrupt. But a year later, Vladimir Putin led Russia to a recovery. Lucky for him, his appointment coincided with increases in world oil prices. These higher prices led Russian oil companies to increase production, and Russia became the world's largest producer of oil and natural gas. Russia quickly paid off its debt, and with its natural gas exports, it found itself with an important strategic weapon. Today, the Germans are dependent on Russia for 43% of their gas imports. If the Russians cut off that flow, there's no ready substitute. No wonder European leaders are unwilling to challenge Russia. They can't afford to. Russia's hostility has other roots, too. Their efforts to encourage South Ossetia and Abkhazia to secede from Georgia was a way of punishing Georgia for seeking NATO membership. The Russians were also angry because Georgia allowed Western companies to build pipelines connecting producers in Central Asia with consumers in Europe. This undercuts Russia's monopoly and its ability to buy gas cheaply in Central Asia and sell it at high prices in Europe. Russia doesn't seem to care if the rest of the world treats it as a bully. Now that its economy has recovered and it has powerful oil and gas weapons to use against those who oppose it, Russia knows that it has a strong hand. And now it knows, we know.
Marshall Goldman is the author, most recently, of Petrostate, Putin, Power, and the New Russia. He's also professor emeritus of economics at Wellesley College. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The economic focus of the Russian offensive in Georgia has been energy. As Professor Goldman just said, Russia is the world's biggest producer of oil and natural gas, and it wants to add another weapon to its arsenal of natural resources, food. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports the Kremlin wants to take direct control over half of Russia's grain exports.
The plan is to group all the Russian government's grain terminals, storage depots, and mills into one operation. Sounds on the face of it innocent enough, a drive for greater efficiency. That's not how some observers see it. Ariel Cohen is with the Washington think tank, the Heritage Foundation.
They want to do to grain what they're doing to natural gas. So Russia is trying to control the supply and eventually the markets of its grain.
Cohen claims this is all part of Putin's grand plan to claw back the superpower status lost when the Soviet Union collapsed. He says by extending state control over Russia's natural resources, the Kremlin hopes to wield more power on the world stage and in the global economy.
They know they cannot compete in biotech, they cannot compete in microelectronics. So instead, Russia is focusing on state control of the commodities, and grain is not an exception.
Like oil and natural gas, grain has soared in price over the past year. But while Russia is an energy superpower, it's not the top dog in grain. It's only the fifth largest exporter, way, way behind the US. So how much grain power could the Kremlin wield? Food security expert Martin Karaher says quite a lot. If the market was already tight and the Russian government suddenly withheld its grain, it could push up world prices.
Potentially, they could have a huge influence on the world market, and that would give them a real political position of power.
You think that in a sense, we ought to be slightly alarmed by this development in Moscow?
I think we should be looking at it.
Russia aims to grab a much bigger slice of the global grain trade. The agriculture minister says within 5 years, Russia could be one of the top three exporters. Agricultural economist Sean Rickard agrees the country could become a really major force in the world grain market.
Russia, according to the United Nations, has perhaps 37 million acres of land that could be brought into cereals production.
But Rickard, for one, doesn't see anything sinister in Russia centralising control over its grain exports.
Most countries want to have some control over exports of food to ensure that those exports are turned back towards the domestic population in times of crises.
Over at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, Ariel Cohen is far more suspicious of Russia's motives.
What could be happening here is Russia will try to create a consortium that may include Ukraine and Kazakhstan, just as they're creating a global OPEC-like natural gas consortium. And therefore, I think both the Europeans and the Americans should be very worried.
No word yet from the Europeans, but an unnamed source within the US government has described the Russian move as a giant step back to the Soviet era. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of the blindingly obvious. $4.50 for a cup of coffee is ridiculous. The public opinion research company Rasmussen Reports did a survey, asked people what they think about Starbucks. Most said they really enjoyed the atmosphere. Free Wi-Fi is nice, and the coffee's good, too. But 73% of us think it's way overpriced. Perhaps that explains why 76% of respondents said they never go there. And somehow, 35% of the adult American population has no opinion whatsoever about the company that seems to have a store on every single corner you look at. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow dropped 139 points, 1.2%. The Nasdaq lost 9 points, nearly 0.4%. The S&P 500 fell 15 points. That is 1.2% there as well. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, saving every penny adds up to a big haul.
It's $1,013.00.
And a whole lot of pennies, too. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.